Welcome to this episode of the PER On Air Ophthalmology Times podcast. Hello and welcome to this podcast. Thyroid eye disease, or TED, a rare autoimmune condition, can be sight-threatening, debilitating, and disfiguring, severely impacting patients' quality of life and daily functioning. Early treatment prevents these complications, but signs of TED are often subtle and can be misinterpreted, leading to delays in diagnosis and treatment. Traditional management approaches for TED have centered on immunomodulatory therapy and surgical interventions. In January 2020, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved teprotumumab, the first therapy specifically indicated for TED. As treatment options evolve, there's an increasing need for a patient-centered, multidisciplinary approach. At the Envision Summit meeting in Puerto Rico, Drs. Sarah Wester, Jennifer Murdoch, Cecilia Ketting, and Sophie Liao spoke about three things that you should know about early treatment intervention for TED. First, Dr. Murdoch, an oculoplastic surgeon based in Miami, reviewed the clinical diagnosis and features of TED.
Now, clinical features of thyroid eye disease. Again, I'm going to say this over and over again. Thyroid eye disease is a chronic autoimmune disease, okay? It lasts the entire lifetime of the patients. Once they have this autoimmune disease, it's never cured, okay? Our goal is always to try to get it to more or less what I like to call a remission state, right? We want it to be subclinical and not causing problems for our patients. When they are first diagnosed, right, or first present with this autoimmune disease, symptoms initially worsen, okay? So on initial presentation of this disease, symptoms start to get really bad, and that after about 12 to 18 months, then they start to improve. And again, this also has a correlation with their thyroid disease if it coexists. So improvement with thyroid disease can also improve their clinical features of their eye disease as well. There are different lingering symptoms that typically persist even after the inflammation starts to resolve. Proptosis is one of them. So proptosis you might see in these chronic patients even after inflammation has gone to really bad and then starts to get better. The changes that happens in the remodeling of the tissues around the eyes can sometimes lead to these permanent effects that stay with a patient in their clinical presentations for forever. Proptosis is one of them. And patients may also present with eyelid retraction, dry eyes, conjunctival injection or irritation, again, which are signs of inflammation. Along with eyelid retraction, which is the most common clinical sign of thyroid eye disease, patients often have eyelid lag on down gaze, which is, you know, von Grafe's sign, exophthalmos or proptosis, eye movement restriction, and double vision. And again, the double vision can be quite debilitating for people in terms of their functionality. And then, of course, ocular surface symptoms. So that's when, you know, the coordination with ophthalmologists, optometrists, oculoplastic surgeons comes into play, because a lot of these patients will really just present with common symptoms that appear to be consistent with dry eye disease. And we have to dive in a little bit further to figure out what's causing this. Now, again, clinical diagnosis. Yes, take all the different pieces of what you see and put it together. Ancillary testing may be beneficial, but it's supportive of your clinical judgment, okay? So orbital imaging can be very helpful, right? On CT or MRI, we're going to see this proptosis. We're going to see expansion of fat, and that's from the inflammation happening within that orbital adipocyte, as well as enlarged extraocular muscles. Also, this is something I know as oculoplastic surgeons, we've learned to read a lot of our imaging ourselves, because I also believe that there's a big gap in radiologists' identification of these changes, and some of them can be more nuanced changes on imaging.
Dr. Murdoch also discussed the signs and symptoms of TED.
We've learned a lot about thyroid eye disease in the past few years, and you know, there's still much to learn, and there's still a lot of our colleagues that have to kind of catch up with, you know, all of this new information. Patients may have minimal findings, and these can be, you know, unrecognized or misdiagnosed, especially when it comes to the practitioners who are not as well-versed about thyroid eye disease and the kind of the nuances of what we know now. Patients have a lot of complaints, right? They may complain about foreign body sensation, photophobia, tearing, which might be very nonspecific. So sometimes when they come and complain to you, it's kind of hard to tease out what's going on with them. And then the examination obviously might reveal mild periorbital swelling, proptosis, eyelid retraction, conjunctival injection. Again, you kind of have to be Sherlock Holmes and put all the little different pieces together to come up with a diagnosis of thyroid eye disease. In your assessment, you know, a couple key things can help you in terms of the data that you collect. So the first one, of course, is exophthalmometry, okay, using a Hertel to measure proptosis. And especially in those early phases or very inflammatory phases, you might detect some changes in those values as patients get worse or better, you know, depending on their treatment. External and slit lamp examination, you definitely want to look at these signs and symptoms of inflammation. Inflammation of the pleca and caruncle is quite specific for thyroid eye disease. So when you see that under a slit lamp, that's something that you might want to think of. Hey, this is kind of an odd finding. You know, when it's really bad, patients will close their eyes and their caruncle will be, you know, hanging out of their eyelids. That is kind of a very like pathognomonic sign for thyroid eye disease. Motility testing, okay, you'll see this restrictive strabismus when patients complaining of double vision. Orbital imaging, thyroid function testing is great, again, for screening. Visual field analysis, quality of life. Metrics can also be very helpful. These patients are not that, like, they're not happy. Their face changes, their eyes changes, their functionality is being interfered. So don't forget to talk to them about how they're feeling, how these symptoms are affecting their quality of life. There are different questionnaires that are actually, you know, data proven that can be useful tools.
Second, the session chair, Dr. Wester, professor of clinical ophthalmology, oculofacial plastic and reconstructive surgery at the University of Miami, asked Dr. Ketting, clinical instructor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, about the role of the optometrist in diagnosing TED.
Dr. Cutting, I'd love to hear from you. What does an optometrist do when you see a patient and you're not sure if it's allergic conjunctivitis, dry eye? How do you manage this? And are there any point of care diagnostic tools that you have integrated that you think are helpful for this?
So I think, you know, putting on that investigative hat that you were talking about is a big thing here, because when you are looking at a red eye, we know redness and other things can come from lots of different underlying etiologies, right? And so when I walk in a room, my exam starts then. I'm watching the patient, I'm looking at the patient. You know, in these cases, there may be some proptosis. It may not be as severe as some of the lovely photos that we had, but that is definitely one of those things that I keep in mind, especially if I'm looking at, majority are female, but we know men as well. And when I'm working up my patient, I ask questions about thyroid levels. These are, you know, any autoimmune issues that we know of that also could be doing, you know, some of these issues. But when we start to think about what's the, you know, clinical presentation, if I'm not seeing other things that lead me to believe that, like, you know, thinking about allergies, if I'm not seeing papillae or I'm seeing, you know, exactly what's going on, I'm very quick to order blood work. I have no problem ordering blood work, and I think that that's something that's really important, especially as an optometrist, is feeling comfortable with that and knowing that, you know what, you may come back with nothing, but it's better to rule things out than to not catch something that's a smaller part of a bigger problem.
Third, Dr. Sophie Liao, Robert H. Bell Endowed Chair in Ophthalmology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, noted that she is seeing a trend in earlier diagnosis of TED through multidisciplinary care.
But I have noticed a trend towards earlier and more often referrals of these patients to our clinic, to the point where they've never had an eye problem or never had eye care, but they're still being referred because of the initial diagnosis of Graves' disease, which is the hyperthyroidism. And I would say if our access was great. That would be amazing. And I will say I struggle a little bit because sometimes these patients have literally no eye symptoms whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, I would prefer that they get referred early because it's always better to have a good baseline exam and to know that, yes, you have hyperthyroidism and we can do some level of counseling before you develop some level of whatever, but patients I find are also often referred with the thought that maybe you already have thyroid eye disease. And many of them, because of the underlying hyperthyroidism, there is a psychosocial effect with that, and there is some level of emotional instability that can sometimes come along with just the thyroid dysfunction that works people up to the point where they're worried they have thyroid eye disease and there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. But we'll end up seeing those types of patients typically once every 6 months for 2-3 visits, and then we end up sending them to optometry care so that we don't lose them and they continue to have baseline eye care and have a way to get back into us quickly. But I think overall the trend in our institution is in a good direction. They should be referred more often than they typically are because often the early symptoms of thyroid eye disease, the tricky thing is that they're often referred too late.
Right.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Dr. Liao also presented a case study of a patient with TED who was treated with teprotumumab.
But one of my patients that improved the best, we had caught him really early. He only had 3 treatments out of the typical 8 of one course. And his proptosis went back 9 millimeters. It was amazing. And he's never recurred. And I think we have better data now that there's actually a fairly high rate of recurrence after a single 8-dose course of teprotumumab. That said, it has honestly been a miracle drug for many of our patients that have tolerated it, minimal side effects for the most part. There are some, you can see there at the bottom, particularly the hearing impairment. Most of us, I think, screen our patients with a baseline hearing exam at this point so that we can be quite clear. There's a lot of stuff out there and patients hear that it might impact their hearing. But otherwise, muscle spasms, diarrhea, some level of headaches, and a couple things like that have been issues with my patients. But they're really minor and they typically go away very quickly. It's been effective in dysthyroid optic neuropathy as well. So very, very small number of patients. And a colleague of mine had a couple of patients in this study as well. But in this very small cohort, 70% responded within 2 infusions with resolution of the pupil defect, improvement of the vision, or both, which was very impressive. And I personally have had patients that we treated for this purpose as well. And anecdotally, it has worked in a couple. So I wouldn't rely only on the IV steroids. I think some of us have changed our sort of treatment algorithm based on some of these smaller studies. Emergent surgery can happen. So we still rarely do have to operate surgically and do an orbital decompression. That's typically taking out 2 or 3 walls of the orbit. Of course, we leave the roof there because it's important stuff on the other side. Corneal desiccation might require repair. So occasionally we're having our corneal colleagues, our dry colleagues help with making sure that the cornea is in good shape. We may do a permanent tarsorrhaphy that we reverse later in at-risk patients as well. Otherwise, the surgery we like to reserve for inactive patients. Do we know everything? Absolutely not. It's one of the first things we tell our patients that we don't know everything about this disease. However, this is no longer a let's throw some radiation, let's throw some steroids at you and hope that we can tide you through until we get you to the point where we're repairing the damage. We are now able to prophylactically treat in a way. The earlier we catch these patients, the faster we can catch them in the course of their disease. And it's truly disease modifying when we can treat them properly.
The symposium faculty offered their clinical pearls in diagnosing and managing TED.
I do spend a lot of time with my thyroid eye disease patients sitting and talking to them. And I agree about the overwhelming part. So what I'll do sometimes is kind of break up that visit, right? I'll kind of tell them about thyroid eye disease as an autoimmune disorder. These are things we can expect. I'll kind of touch on the highlights. And, if it's not something severe, I'll try to, order my imaging, order my labs, and then bring them back for a follow-up so we can delve in a little bit more into the nuances of the management options and the side effects. But I think it's super important to be very transparent and let the patient decide what they want to do. Give them the risks and benefits of each of the options that I would recommend to them at their stage. And then kind of have that discussion with them because it is a discussion. There are a lot of options. And what I might recommend is the highest option they might not be into at all. And it's just a
collaborative effort between you and the patient to sort of figure out how their journey is going to go, because this is a forever journey. Mm-hmm. It's not a one and done sort of thing. So you have to work together on it.
I think that's a very, very good point. I think we get to know these patients quite well. And you also, some patients come in with a fair amount of information and better understanding, and some patients really don't have the background understanding. So you really have to spend time with them and do it in bits and pieces that is appropriate to their severity of disease, right? Obviously, if someone comes in with DON, you need to treat them differently. But I do think just the longevity and the ongoing discussion is really important. And that's why I like seeing patients earlier and then monitoring if I can. I want to mention one thing that someone mentioned, I think you did, is to me, point of care testing, we've kind of talked about, but one thing to know is look at previous photos. If someone comes in and says, my eyes feel different, say, hey, do you have a picture? And everybody has a picture. They have iPhones. And if you look and they do look different, I'd be really concerned about it. I think we miss, I have patients that don't maybe look proptotic until you see the pre-photo. So I don't.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Thank you for joining us for this PER On Air Ophthalmology Times podcast.